I'd like to thank Tom for inviting me to teach this morning, and he asked me to teach the book of Esther. And I told him that we would go to the movies this morning. So we're going to the movies. I guess you might call this a chick flick. It's not really. Not really. I thought it was kind of appropriate that it was just men that stood up for manifestations this morning. So we're going to do the book of Esther. It's a great book. Some amazing things in Esther. One of the things that I saw when I looked at some of the commentaries on this book was that everybody takes note of the fact that the word God does not come up in the book of Esther. And that seems to be the big deal to all the theologians and the scholars, is that God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. But I think you're going to see as we go through this book that if God is not mentioned, it has to be some kind of figure of speech, because God is the driving force behind the book of Esther. And if this specific situation had not happened, we may not even be sitting here today. This was a very crucial point in the history of the children of Israel, and it was also a very crucial point in God's plan of salvation. What God was able to do through Mordecai and his cousin Esther literally changed the face of the earth. It was a very, very powerful story. The story of Esther takes place at the midpoint during the captivity, also known as the exile of the children of Israel. It happened sometime between 465 and 480 B.C. A number of years earlier, the nation of Israel had separated into two nations. Remember, there was Israel on the northern part, and then there was Judah on the southern part. 10 tribes stayed in Israel on the northern part. Judah formed the southern nation. The northern nation of Israel fell into idolatry much faster than Judah did, and they basically were gone at a certain period of time spiritually. Judah hung on for a little bit longer. The last good king of Judah was King Josiah. And King Josiah was the one that went through and cleaned out all the high places, cleaned up the idolatry, killed the prophets of Baal, and basically turned the country back into a godly state. But it was very short-lived. As a matter of fact, Josiah died when he was about 31, 32 years old, I think. He died in battle. He picked a fight with the king of Egypt, and he got killed. And his sons that reigned in his stead took the whole nation of Judah and flipped it right back around to idolatry immediately. And because of that, God could no longer protect them. And they went into captivity. They went into exile. Those events set the stage for both nations to be conquered and taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. The children of Israel were then separated from the Promised Land and spread throughout the Babylonian Empire. And that's an important thing to know. They were spread everywhere. Hundreds and hundreds of miles, the children of Israel were spread because of this captivity. They were taken into Babylon. Remember Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They were taken into Babylon. That's how they wound up there. It was because of the sins of the children of Israel. It was because they wouldn't walk with their father, with God, and they were taken into exile because of it. A number of years later, the Babylonian Empire was itself conquered by the Persian Empire, and the Persian Empire was a huge, huge empire. It's at one point, at the point of Esther's story, it stretched all the way from India to Ethiopia, which is about 2,000 miles. And some of the historians believe that that empire at that time in history was the most powerful, quote, nation on the face of the earth. And the children of Israel were spread all throughout that empire. The story of Esther centers in the city of Shushan. And Shushan is east of Babylon. Babylon was centered between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And the Tigris and Euphrates rivers go up the eastern side of what is today known as Iraq. Shushan is over in the southern part of Iran, which is to the east of Iraq. Shushan is about 800 miles east of Jerusalem. So this grouping of the children of Israel that were centered around Shushan were about 800 miles from the Promised Land. Shushan is also located about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf. Remember the Persian Gulf? It was much in the news about 14 years ago. It's over in that area. And that Shushan was the summer palace of King Ahasuerus, who was at that time the king over all of the Persian Empire. So that's the background on this story. Esther, chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus by the way, I pronounce these words. There's a lot of names that come up in Esther. I pronounce them according to the pronunciation in my Bible, and Bibles vary. My Bible's a 30-year-old Cambridge. This is just the way they say to pronounce these. So if you pronounce them a little bit differently, it doesn't matter. I'm just using my reference here. So now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, that is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign. Bullinger says that at this point in time, he was about 17 years old. They say he started his reign when he was about 14. That seems young to me, but since I don't know any better, we'll say he was a young man. And Bullinger also says that he married Queen Vashti when he was 14, which meant she was probably about the same age too. So these were some young people. And an interesting thing about this is we're going to see that this king Ahasuerus throws a huge party. If he was really that young, this isn't money that he earned. It's a great example of the next generation spending all their father's money. But in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all the provinces and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. That's one big long party. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present at Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black and marble. You know, he pulled out all the stops. This is quite a production he put on. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And one thing you're going to notice about Ahasuerus is that he liked his wine. And that's part of the story, actually. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel. One of the translators says that this is translated wrong. The way it should be translated is, and the drinking was according to the king's freedom, and none was compelled to not drink, or none was compelled to stop drinking. In other words, as much as you want, as long as you want it. Okay? For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven chamberlains. Chamberlains were eunuchs. You all know what a eunuch was? Well, I'm not going to explain it right now. The chamberlains that served in the presence of King Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. Several of the translations translate this verse to bring Vashti the queen before the king wearing only her crown royal. And some of the scholars insist that that's the way it should be translated, that he wanted her to come out just wearing her royal crown. One of the other commentaries I read said that it probably wasn't that he wanted her to come out naked, but that in that culture all the women were covered. You just didn't come out without a veil over your face. But he wanted all of his drunk buddies to look at this woman and to see how pretty she was, and even that would have been a breach of protocol. And it would have been embarrassing for this group of drunk men to look at this woman, to see her face and to see how beautiful she was. So either way, perhaps this queen wasn't so stupid after all. She just didn't want to be embarrassed. But he wanted to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come in at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. He was mad because she wouldn't come out. Then the king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment, and the next unto him was Karshina, Shethar, Edmatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media. which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, and it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. So they expected a little open revolt, a little women's suffrage going to happen here. And the women are going to despise their husbands. They're not going to respect their husbands because the queen didn't do what the king wanted. So they made a decree. And one of the interesting things about Persian kings is they made a lot of decrees. And when a Persian king made a decree, according to the Persian law, it was not allowed to be changed. It's not like our laws that can be changed, you know, just at random. But those laws were never changed. So they made a decree and they sent it out that all the women were supposed to respect their husbands and that the husbands were supposed to bear rule in their homes, and this was the new decree. Chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. And remember, he made a decree that she would no longer be queen. So no matter what he felt like, no matter how he changed his mind, it was too late. And this is important to know because this is the setting that Esther comes into. We have a queen that refused to come in before the king. The king divorced her. There was a decree went out that all women must be in subjection to their husbands. And now she's coming onto the scene. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins in Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hegi, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah. And this Jeconiah was one of Josiah's sons, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah is just her Hebrew name. Esther is her Persian name. His uncle's daughter. So Esther is Mordecai's uncle's daughter. So that makes her what to him? It's his cousin. He brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. She was also an orphan. It doesn't say how her father and mother died, but they weren't there. So she's this little, probably very young woman from, her ancestry was from Judah, and she had no father and mother. And Mordecai, her cousin, was going to raise her as one of her parents. Her father and mother were dead, he took for his own daughter. It came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also into the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. I've heard this taught before where they thought that she did this willingly. That this is just the thing that the young women did. You know, it was a pleasure. It was a privilege to go be part of the king's harem. And yet, this phrase was brought. Go to Jeremiah for a second. Just to give you a little insight into this situation. Jeremiah 48. Jeremiah 48 and verse 46. Woe be unto thee, O Moab, the people of Chemosh perisheth, for thy sons are taken captives, and thy daughters are captive. See that little phrase there, are taken? It's translated from the same word back in Esther. Go back to Esther. And it's a word in the Hebrew that's not used very often. And most of the usages of this word indicate that that which is taken, sometimes it's a person, sometimes it's an inanimate object, that the will of that object or the will of that person is not taken into consideration. You could say they're taken against their will, or that their will was not part of it. It's the same phrase here. She was brought. She didn't have anything to do with this. This was something that they just did. She's a good-looking young woman, and the king wants women. And in that culture, the king owned the entire nation. Everything belonged to the king. So it was just expected. You have a daughter that's beautiful. The king wants her. She goes. But she was taken. It was not probably her idea or her desire to do this. And yet, the remarkable thing we'll learn about Esther is that she was a believer. And she wound up in a situation where she actually saved the entire nation of Israel. So there are times when you do things, perhaps, that you don't want to do. And this was pretty radical. This was pretty out there. I'm going to go live with the king. And he was a pagan. He was a pagan. He wasn't even one of the children of Israel. You know, what dreams did little Israeli girls have when they were younger? I'm sure it wasn't to marry a pagan king that liked to drink and divorce his wives. And it had a harem full of women. This is a tough situation for a little orphan Jewish girl. But she was taken into the king's house to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her all things for purification with such things as belonged to her, and 7 maidens which were meet to be given her out of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. You know, she must have just been a remarkable young woman. Everywhere she went, she reminds me of Joseph with the people that he met in Egypt. Everybody that met her just loved her. You know, she's attractive. She's kind. She's loving. She's just a wonderful little woman. And even the guy who took care of the virgins loved her. Esther had shown her people, had not shown her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Another thing you'll notice about Esther is that she did what Mordecai asked her to do continually. You know, she stayed in subjection, so to speak, to the man that raised her. Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go in to King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of the women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. So they made them pretty and they made them smell good. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with him out of the house of the women into the king's house. On the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women to the custody of Sheazgaz, the king's chamberlain. This is another eunuch, which kept the concubines. So the first house is where they kept the virgins. These are the young women. And they would go one by one at the king's urging in to spend a night with the king. When they came out of the house with the king, they went to the second house, which is the house of the concubines. They're no longer virgins. They're in the house of the concubines. So, it's make a great movie, wouldn't it? Hey, it's in the Bible. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. Now in the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. And Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus, into his house royal, in the 10th month, which is in the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So if Bollinger's right, he's about how old? 7th year of his reign. If in his 3rd year he was 17, he's about 21. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor. The word favor means kindness. In his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Which is pretty cool. She didn't wind up in the house of the concubine. She gets married. She winds up the queen. So, then the king made a great feast unto all the princes and his servants, even Esther's feast, and he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts. He threw another party. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat at the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh. Sounds like a couple of World Wrestling Federation fighter. Tonight's match, we have Bigthan and Teresh. Of those, and their eunuchs, which is partly why they were so mad. Of those... of those which kept the door were wroth, means they were mad, and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. Now, after these things, King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Here comes the villain. How many people know what an Agagite was? Somebody does. Remember King Agag? King Agag, remember Saul was supposed to destroy the Amalekites back in Samuel? The Amalekites were the first nation to attack the children of Israel when they came into the Promised Land. They attacked them from behind, and Joshua beat them back. But from that point on, the Amalekites became one of the top enemies of the children of Israel. Throughout all history, they were. And King Saul was told to get rid of the Amalekites, and he didn't do it. And he saved King Agag alive and brought him back, remember? And Samuel then hacked him up in pieces. This guy's an Agagite. He comes from that background. So he comes from a family that hates the children of Israel to begin with. These guys are perpetually at war with the children of Israel. And he's advanced. He advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. In essence, he became like the prime minister. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. It was wrong, according to God's will and according to God's law, for one man to bow to another man. It's written in the law. Mordecai was a believer. He wasn't about to bow for this guy. It was like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the same stock. So these children that were spread out throughout the entire empire, there were still believers there. There were still people that believed God's word, that trusted God's word. And here's one of them. He said, I'm going to bow down to this guy. I don't care who he is. Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Verse 3. In verse 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. Now Haman's mad. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for he had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. And here's the real problem. What would have happened if the children of Israel had been wiped out? The promise would have ended. Would we be sitting here? I don't think so. And this is in the entire empire of Persia, which went all the way from India to Ethiopia, 2,000 miles. All the way up from Greece down to what is now southern part of Iran. It's a huge area. It's almost as big as the United States. Perhaps every Jew that existed was in there. And they want to get rid of all of them. Wipe them out. Get rid of them. Verse 8. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's prophet to suffer them or to allow them. If it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business. So he's not only going to have them destroyed, but he's going to give, it's a money incentive. This is a lot of money, by the way. This is like several tons of silver. I'm going to give you several tons of silver if you allow these Jews to be destroyed. Verse 10, the king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, which meant when you gave your ring to someone, it gave them full authority to speak for you. So what Haman did was he put out a decree, and the decree was kill the Jews. They sent a letter to all the provinces, verse 13. The letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Chapter 4. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth, because that was an embarrassment to the king. You weren't allowed to show up at the gate in sackcloth. But Mordecai, I don't care. This is wrong, and I'm sad, and I'm going to go stand in front of the gate. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. And Hatak went forth to Mordecai into the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the Jews' treasuries for the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. So now Esther, the queen, knows what's going on. And he gave him a copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to charge it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king, to make supplication unto him, and to make request before him for her people. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Again Esther spake unto Hatak, and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. And the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called or is not invited, there is one law of his to put him to death. And remember, these laws were irreversible. So if somebody goes into the king's chamber and just shows up, says, I want to talk to you, and the king has not invited him, and he doesn't invite him at that point, he's dead. And she knows this. There is one law of his to put them to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. You know, if this happens and the Jews get killed, you're going with them. And remember, they don't know Esther's background. The king doesn't know that he's married a Jew. But somebody does. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. In my mind, this is the whole key to the book of Esther right here. And this is the whole key to Mordecai. Shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place? This is why I think God is in the middle of this book. Because here's a man who believed in the promise. You know, he knew that if maybe he's going to die, maybe Esther's going to die, maybe those closest to the king are going to die, but the Jews are not going to all die. That's his confession. We're not all going to die. Was this just a positive confession? I don't think so. I think this is a believer. I think this is a man that's saying, you know what? You want to be part of this plan? Great. But if you're not part of this plan, God's still going to take care of us. You know, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Just like Daniel. You know, God's going to take care of us. And that's the whole key to the book right there. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? I thought of this a couple weeks ago. Tom and I were talking after his teaching last week, and he's been doing this series on Ephesians for several weeks. And we were kind of joking about, well, we're going to go from a series on Ephesians to Esther, and how do those two tie together? Well, they do tie together. They tie together very, very clearly, because Ephesians is the culmination of God's plan of redemption. And this is part of God's plan of redemption. You know, he taught a couple weeks ago that God had a purpose and a desire and a plan. Well, this is all part of it. And Mordecai, for him to bail out at this point and to give up and to not recognize that God had a plan of deliverance for the children of Israel, well, somebody else would have stepped up, because God's promise was going to be fulfilled. It just happened that it worked through Mordecai and Esther. Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer: go, gather together all the Jews that are present in the Shushan, and fast ye for me. Why did they fast? Why do people fast in the Old Testament? Let's look at an example. Turn to Esther. Go back two books. Ezra. Ezra. By the way, Ezra and Nehemiah, chronologically, should come after Esther. Go back to Ezra, chapter 8. As a matter of fact, the record in Esther set up the stage for the later events that happened with Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember Nehemiah went to ask the king if he could go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem? The king that he asked was the same king. In the book of Nehemiah, is called Artaxerxes, but it's the same king. So this situation that's being set up right now continued on to getting some of the Jews back into Jerusalem and getting the city rebuilt. In Ezra chapter 8, in verse 21, matter of fact, Nehemiah was King Ahasuerus' wine bearer. So 20 years later, he's still drinking wine when Nehemiah asked him for permission to go back to Jerusalem. Let's see, I'm in Ezra 8. Verse 21, then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek of him a right way for us and for our little ones and for our substance. You know, Esther didn't just fast to, you know, lose a few pounds so she looks better for the king. She asked for fasting so that people would go to their God for help. And that's why they fasted in the Old Testament. Fast for me, I'm in verse 16, and neither eat nor drink these days, 3 days, night and day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And I will go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and told and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Now it came to pass on the third day, that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against the gate of the house. And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So the scepter. Then said the king unto her, what wilt thou, Queen Esther? And what is thy request? It shall be given unto thee to the half of the kingdom. Now, this is a man who loves this woman. You want half the kingdom? This is a 2,000-mile kingdom. She's starting to pull a lot of weight. Esther answered, if it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. Why didn't she just bust him right here? Wouldn't you? You got the guy sitting there. She's going to bust him. She's going to bring him in and bust him, right? Wouldn't you want to bust him right then? Then the king said, cause Haman to make haste and eat, that he may do as Esther hath said. So the king said, the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine. There's that wine again. What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to half of the kingdom. It shall be performed. Then answered Esther and said, my petition and my request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king hath said. Why didn't she bust him right here? Because she was a believer. And sometimes it's good to keep your mouth shut. Sometimes it's good to wait until God says move. Then went Haman forth that day joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. Here's this nemesis of his again, just sitting there. He's not going to stand up. He's not going to bow down. And old Haman just gets all upset. Go down to the end of the chapter. He goes home and he complains to his wife and his family. He's got this huge family. He's got 10 kids. Matter of fact, one of the historians says he had 208 children. So I don't know if that's true or not, but he was rather prolific. He tells his wife, Zeresh, this Jew, he won't bow down. He cries to his wife. Verse 14, then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high. A cubit is the distance from here to here. On average, about 15, 18 inches. They figured that this gallows was about 75 feet tall. And a gallows in this culture was not a big a platform. It was a stake. They would go take the trunk out of one of the cedars of Lebanon and they would sharpen it. And then they would hoist somebody up to the top of this thing and stick them on it. And it was a common practice in that culture to stick people on these big stakes and then just leave them around as an intimidation for whatever political thing you were trying to move. And there would be some cities where they'd take these stakes and they'd stick them up all around the outside of the city after they'd taken it and stick people on them. That's a nasty way to die. This, by the way, is the way Judas died. He fell on a stake and his bowels gushed out. That's what it says in Acts. It was, you know, he didn't hang himself like this, like some movies say. He hung himself on a stake. Well, they want to do this to Mordecai. But chapter 6, on that night, could not the king sleep. And he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, that the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king of Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. Interesting coincidence. That night, Esther had him in her sights. She had the king's ear. She could have busted him. But that night, the king can't sleep. Sometimes that happens when you have too much wine. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Another coincidence. Haman just happens to be walking in. I'm going to get the king's permission. I'm going to stick that guy on a pole 75 feet up in the air. The king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in. And the king said unto him, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? Pride becometh before a fall. Yeah, here's a man that thinks, you know, the king, oh, I'm it. Who could delight in anybody more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king uses to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and this horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. He's just setting himself up. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horses thou hast said, and do even to Mordecai the Jew. Oh, no. Oh, no. That sitteth at the king's gate, let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Then took Haman the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and brought him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Boy, I would love to see this in a movie. And Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house mourning and having his head covered. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. Man, even in exile, after all these years, the Jews were still feared. You're going to go up against this guy, you are a dead man. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. Coincidental timing, eh? So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day, at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to half of the kingdom. Now it's time. Now it's time. The time to let this guy have it. She's been patient. They fasted for 3 days. Mordecai went through his sackcloth and ashes time. And now it's time. It's set up. Haman has built a gallows 75 feet high, stake sharpened to the top, ready to kill Mordecai. The king couldn't sleep. The king read the royal record and found out that Mordecai had never been thanked publicly for saving the king. And now Esther's ready. Now this little orphan girl who was raised by her cousin and living in captivity in exile probably had zero desire to wind up in this situation. She's now at a point where she can save her entire nation. And she's ready. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. So now she lets him know who she is. My people. She tells the king, it's my people. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. In other words, if we were just going to be sold into slavery, I wouldn't have bothered you with this. This is a small thing, being sold into slavery. But because they want to kill us, I'm going to talk to you about this. Verse 5, then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, who is he? Where is he that durst presume in his heart to do this? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Busted. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther, the queen. For he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. And the king returned out of the palace garden unto the palace of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. He's all upset. She's sitting on a couch in the banquet area. She's sitting on a couch, and he realizes he's dead. The king goes out of the room. He's mad. He takes a walk. He comes back in, and here's Haman hanging on the couch, you know, crying for his life. I told you this would make a good movie. Rosie's thinking how she can produce this movie. I can see it. That's the actor in her. So here's Haman falling on the bed of Esther. Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? You know, he thinks he's trying to rape his wife. As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. You can just see them pull the thing down of his face. He's going to be toast. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai. Imagine that. Right around the corner is a stake in the air. Who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him thereon. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. But you know what? The problem's not over. They got rid of the guy who started the problem. But remember, when the king of Persia makes a law, it can't be broken. You can't change it. You can't think the story's over here because Haman's gone, because he's already made a law. He took his ring and he put his signet ring on a bunch of letters that went all over the country and told the people of that entire empire to kill the Jews. He can't change that. Even the king can't change that. They're toast. So Haman's gone, but it ain't the end of the story. On that day did King Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the king's enemy, to Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. So now the king knows that he's married one of the children of Israel, and that her cousin, this Mordecai, who had sat at the gate, is her cousin. And he promotes Mordecai into the position of prime minister. So Mordecai now becomes the second most powerful man in the probably the most powerful empire in the world. So don't tell me God isn't part of this story. You can't. There's no other explanation for this. And the way all of these events lined up and how certain people were at certain places at certain times, and the king couldn't sleep, so he just happened to pull the records and read the one record. How many records were in there? This is 127 provinces, 2,000 miles wide. How many things could he have gone to? They'd been in war after war after war after war. There were tons of records. There still are. There are tons of records about this time period. And he just happens to go to the one about Mordecai. Don't tell me God's not involved in this stuff. This is God's plan from Genesis 3:15 on. I am going to give you a redeemer. But people sometimes look at this book. I read some of the commentaries that thought that this book perhaps didn't even fit in the Bible because it doesn't mention God and because you don't specifically see people pray in here, although they just don't understand what fasting means. There was a debate about this. Almost didn't make it in here. And yet you see God's plan of redemption through this book so clearly. These people are spread out hundreds of miles from Jerusalem. They're in bondage. They're in exile. And yet God still had people at the right place at the right time to continue his promise of salvation. Oh, it absolutely belongs in the Bible. And it absolutely has God's stamp all over it. You know, sometimes when I read these Old Testament records, I think about what these things taught Jesus Christ. You know, we talk about that we need to work the Word of God in the context. You can't take a book like Esther or any of the books in the Bible and take them out of the context of the whole Bible. The whole Bible is a context, and the context of God's Word is his plan of redemption and his Son, Jesus Christ. You know, our salvation as Christians was not dependent on our knowledge of the Word of God. And that's wonderful. I mean, if God said, you know, you got to know the entire Old Testament, you got to know everything in there before I give you salvation. He could have done that, I guess. But our salvation was not dependent on our knowledge of the Old Testament. And yet, I think about Jesus Christ reading this record and records like this. You know, was our salvation dependent on his knowledge of the Old Testament, on him knowing the Old Testament? I think you can make a pretty good case for that. Did he quote the scripture? Did he know what was written? What did this mean to him to read about his heritage and to read about what God did to get this plan of redemption, to get him to where he was? He was born into a land that was in exile, that was in captivity. You know, what did it mean to his mind when he was 16 years old, thinking, is this the promised land? We're under domination. You know, he had to go through those thoughts. He had to figure out how the Word of God fit. Can you see him reading this? It must have just blown his mind. Look what God did to get this thing put together. And here I am. I'm it. I just think it's a remarkable thing. I think about that sometimes when I'm reading the Old Testament. Not so much what it means for me. It means a lot for me. But what did it mean to him to sit there and read this stuff? And to see what God did to protect his bloodline, to protect his plan. And here's just an incredible example of it. In the midst of the most dark, strange circumstances, a pagan king with harems, concubines, too much wine, crazy people, sons of Agag, and yet he still, the way God just amazingly cuts through all the stuff and gets his job done. But he's got one more job to do, and that's to somehow stop this commandment to kill all the Jews. Verse 3, chapter 8. And Esther spake again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter towards Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come upon my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Then the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows because he had laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it liketh you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring, for the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. Then were the king's scribes called at the time in the third month, that is the month of Sivan, in the 23rd day thereof, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants, and to the deputies, and to the rulers of provinces which are from India unto Ethiopia, 127 provinces. Remember, Mordecai is now, in essence, the prime minister. And he's got the stamp of approval from King Ahasuerus. To the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing, and according to their language. And he wrote in the King Ahasuerus' name, and sealed it with the king's ring, and sent letters by post on horseback, and riders on mules, camels, and young dromedaries. Wherefore the king granted the Jews, and this is the way he reversed this. He didn't really reverse it. He put another law in effect that, well, you'll see. Wherein the king granted the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the power of the people and the province that would assault them. So these are people that were in exile, that had been taken into captivity. The king can't reverse this order that they're going to be destroyed. So what he tells them is, you can defend yourselves. You can fight back. Now remember, the Jews were feared by a lot of people. As a matter of fact, what happened as a result of this is that a lot of people in the land, it says that they became Jews, and they went through and just cleaned house. The next thing that happens is Mordecai went into King Haman's house, takes all 10 of his sons, sticks them on the pole, and then the children of Israel just went through and just cleaned out all their enemies. And then they lived in somewhat relative peace for a period of time after that. And it was because of these events and because of this wonderful Queen Esther and her cousin Mordecai that people were allowed, later on, Nehemiah and Esther were allowed to go back and to rebuild the temple and rebuild the walls. As a matter of fact, there was somewhat of a... This King Ahasuerus turned out to be not so bad guy. Not such a bad guy. Because, you know, he married a wonderful woman. She was a believer. And God's plan of salvation, God's plan of redemption was continued on. And yet it came that close. It came that close to getting wiped out. All because of one Agagite. But God put this wonderful young woman, orphan girl, in a position of prominence. and just opened up this entire Persian Empire to her. So I would say God's in the middle of this book. Matter of fact, I think God's in the middle of lots of things. So that's the story of Esther. There's, of course, a lot more to read here. And whoever wants to make the movie, I'll write the soundtrack for it. So. That's it. Rosie, would you stand and pray, please?
Well, Father, I want to thank you for just taking care of your people throughout the ages, God, and just letting us know that there is kind of redemption and that it was completed by your Son, Jesus Christ. And I just thank you for...